All right, the last matter we have on calendar today is docket number 80210, In Re Guardianship of Powell. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
We are.
All right, and we do appreciate the masks, but as you come up, please feel free to take them off. Yep. Would you like to reserve any time?
2 minutes, please.
Okay.
Justices, good afternoon. Thank you for having us here today. My name is Scott Bogatz. I'm with the firm of Reed Rubenstein Bogatz. With me today is my colleague, Carrie Kleiman. Also, I'd like to introduce the court to our law clerk from Boyd Law School, Shane Diggin.
We have a lot of law school people here.
Yes.
We have a lot of law school people here right now.
I thought they looked familiar.
All of them.
And we also, I think, on your virtual system have the petitioner, Mr. Powell, who's watching through the through your virtual court system. As I said, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes. I'm going to do the introduction and the policy discussion, and then Ms. Kleiman's going to come up and apply the facts of the case to the standard that we think the court should adopt. The first thing I'd like to say is I thought the briefs from both the respondent and the amicus brief were very well done, and particularly the amicus brief, and I want to focus on it. At page, I think, 9 of the amicus brief, Ms. Richards writes, guardianships of adults affect the most fundamental rights of an individual. An estate may not deprive a person of these rights without notice and a meaningful opportunity to be heard. And then she cites the 5th and 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution, which means that we're in the right place to argue this. Either here or the other Supreme Court would be the right place for these particular issues. Because I think this case does get to some fundamental issues that are going to become more and more important to our society as the society evolves. And particularly it has to do with adult guardianships and how that process occurs. Now, the division that Ms. Richards represents went on in her brief to say that the adult guardianship statutes are like a shield. They're there to protect the person that the petition is being sought after, both in terms of protecting their rights and protecting their interests if a guardianship is appropriate. And I completely agree. We think that is the issue that stands before us. Now, when a petition is filed, the odds and the landscape are stacked strongly against the petition, as I think they should be. The legislature, in their wisdom, and correctly I think so, said you need to get to a clear and convincing standard. Since 1999, somebody from the legal aid office of whatever jurisdiction is appointed to represent the person over whom a guardianship is sought. If the petitioner loses the petition, the court can assess them fees for the attorney that was hired on behalf of the person whose guardianship is being sought. And then you just simply have the standard bias. You have the essentially what the division is saying. Our entire system is devoted to make sure that the government doesn't take away a person's rights and powers without due process. So the petitioner that comes in, either paying for an attorney with their own money, which is not very likely in these circumstances, or more likely, like Mr. Powell, pro per, comes in and starts the process. And I think, as we all know, that's very hard to do when you're acting pro se and you're trying to get through a petition process, particularly when there's lawyers on the other side, when there's a high standard, when there's a division of the government who's meant to oversee it and make sure that nothing goes wrong in it. So you start through that process, and it's often not articulately done. It's often not presented in the way that lawyers would normally present to the court. So you get through that petition process with the goal of getting to an evidentiary hearing, with the goal of having the judge look at the situation, listen to what the psychologist in this case had to say, or what Loretta's son had to say about it, so that an objective determination can be made. The problem is, if the standard is set too high, you're gonna overbalance things so far that you risk falling through the cracks, where people who need a guardian appointed don't get a guardian appointed because the system is designed adversarial. And it always is. I've been in front of this court on a number of occasions, and I'm always here saying my client was, the rights were abrogated, or my client wasn't treated fairly, or a decision was made poorly or improperly, and the other side fights with me. That's how the system is designed, except when you get to guardianships. We're not talking about anybody's rights except for the person who the appointment is being made to protect. And we don't want to overbalance the system so far that we risk not getting the guardianship at least considered at the district court level.
Why isn't it sufficient for the court to determine whether it needs an evidentiary hearing in this regard?
Because of the way that the system is designed, and Ms. Kleiber will show you the specific facts that they had in front of them here, but when you've got a system where everything is weighed against it, and so a petitioner like Mr. Powell comes in and he's got a document from a psychologist, he thinks he is presenting the information correctly, but it's hard to get through that
but
system.
What right... Mr. Powell, nobody's going to take anything from him. It's Loretta Powell who you're going to take her liberty. So, you know, Mr. Powell, I don't see where Mr. Powell necessarily weighs in as significantly here, so we should vindicate his hearing. I agree with DHHS, or I always get too many H's, too little, DHHS, you know, proposition that certainly for before you take someone's liberty interest, they should have an evidentiary hearing. You're going to have to persuade me that Mr. Powell is in the same footing.
And I won't even try. Okay. Mr. Powell or any petitioner in this context is not the person that we're worried about. We're really not. Mm-hmm. We're worried about the Lorettas of the world, the people over whom the petition is being asserted. And that view of it is the common view. It's the view I have, that Ms. Kleiman has, that most courts have, is wait a second, you're trying to take over somebody's dominion and control, and I'm going to look at that jaundicedly. And you should. Absolutely. It's why the standards are so strong and they get a court-appointed attorney.
But Mr. Botex, mm-hmm. What about the fact that Chapter 159 doesn't mandate an evidentiary hearing for your client?
It's an excellent question, Justice Silver. It does mandate that the court take evidence and enter findings, but it doesn't talk about mandating an evidentiary hearing. I'd love to try and convince you to order that there be an evidentiary hearing, but this court's already said they're not going to do that. In the Christina O case that I think we've all cited, it's unpublished, but this court in a footnote said we're not going to write in a mandate for an evidentiary hearing where there isn't one.
So how is this reversible error on abuse of discretion if there's no mandate for an evidentiary hearing?
What this court can do, should do, and does all the time is set the standards on how discretion is operated, what level, what standard the district court should apply. Summary judgment cases have one standard, motions to dismiss another standard, different types of hearings. And what this court can say to the district court is, what the district court did, and Ms. Kleiman will get into this, is said, I need clear and convincing evidence to get you to an evidentiary hearing. What this court can say
that's
is...
That's because there was a power of attorney in this particular case, which the level of competence must be greater to... do a power of attorney. That's why I took it as the district court judge talked about clear and convincing.
The standard, I agree with. It's when you apply the standard. Our position, Ms. Kleiman's and I, is that that's too much. You're stacking the table too high to say a pro se litigant has to convince the court by clear and convincing evidence in the preliminaries, in the petition phase, just to be able to sit in front of the judge and present the evidence and the testimony.
Well, if it's pro se or an attorney, doesn't the district court have to make sure that either side complies with 159? And in this case, your client's petition was the affidavit by the doctor, the declaration was deficient. It didn't even meet Chapter 159's elements.
That I agree with you, Justice Silver. I think at the evidentiary hearing phase, I think if you say as our society ages And as this becomes a more and more prevalent issue, if we're going to say to the majority of petitioners who are going to be pro se, you have to hit these levels at a clear and convincing standard before you get to present it in person and through evidentiary testimony to the judge, you're going to wind up too far. You're going to wind up, because again, it's not them we're protecting, not the petitioner we're protecting. It's the people that need the protection. It's why there's a statute, right? There's a statute because some percentage of the population isn't going to think they need this level of protection, but they do. To go through that and say to a petitioner, you've got to do this right, you've got to defeat lawyers on the other side. If you lose, you might have to even pay these lawyers. And you got to do all of that to a clear and convincing level before you get your actual evidentiary day in court. You're going to miss people who need guardianships, is our belief.
What prevents your client to have gone to legal aid pro se and getting representation the same as, you know, the court, or the court can do it? I mean, certainly your client, who maybe didn't have the money, was disabled, certainly could have gone right into legal aid, walked in and said, I need help for my mom, and been represented by legal aid.
It is a fair question, although, and it might be a good question to the other side, I don't think legal aid could actually do it. In fact, when we were hired on a pro bono basis, it didn't go through legal aid because they have a conflict because they're on the other side. So it went through a different process to get our firm engaged on a pro bono basis. It's not easy as a pro se person to go through and find somebody at legal aid to begin with just because of life. They even have a conflict because of the way the statutes were built. And the reality is, it's going to be a mainly pro se process on the petitioner's side. I think this court can protect it by setting that discretionary standard.
I do want to hear factually why this might be different, but just briefly, shouldn't it be a high standard so that people like Ms. Powell are not subject to these intrusions, getting dragged into court, having to defend an evidentiary hearing? Wouldn't we want a higher standard before we make that person come into court to defend their own autonomy? Because it creates an imposition for her, too.
As I get older, Your Honor, I think it should be even a higher and higher standard. We are not here to argue the standard. It should be clear and convincing. They should have counsel. There should be this bias. But they should get their day in court. I mean, just to be honest, you recently on the bench, Your Honor, every time as a litigant I get a pro per party on the other side, I'm winning that case at first. It looks like they're not even going to get through the process. But I don't know the rules as well, but Ms. Kleinman can marshal us through the rules and get the briefs filed and meet those technical requirements. Sometimes when you finally get that pro person in front of the judge on an evidentiary basis, both myself as the litigant and the judge sits back and says, well, that's a little better case than it sounded like when it was inartfully drafted and inartfully pled in the preliminaries. That's all we're saying is, set the standard more realistic and advise the district court that essentially as long as they have a prima facie case, they should be able to get to an evidentiary hearing. They shouldn't have to win that by clear and convincing. Then apply the clear and convincing standard. And if you don't think there should be a guardianship, great. That's the protection, and that's your job. I am going to sit down and let Ms. Kleinman have the last couple of minutes on the factual issues.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. The facts of this case, as I think Justice Stiglitz was getting at with Mr. Bogatz, is there isn't just a complete absence of information. Mr. Powell, acting pro se, did have a disability certificate that was signed by a psychiatrist, who is a licensed medical doctor.
And I guess that's where I struggle a little bit, because it wasn't compliant with the factors that need to be considered under 159.044.2.
Yes.
It didn't even meet that threshold.
That's accurate. That's very true.
And that's a statutory requirement, though, right?
Yes. And I do think that this is where what Mr. Bogatz was saying comes into play. At that point, there was a colloquy between Judge Sturman and counsel for Loretta, which was going over the concerns raised in this physician's report. I think at that point, what the statute says is that the judge can prescribe the form of any assessment that gets done. And I think that that's where Mr. Powell, if he had been represented or if he had been a little bit savvier, may have known, okay, I need to go and get this form filled out the right way. As far as he knew, this certificate was enough. It was used at the Department of Education. It listed these problems that say Loretta cannot manage her own finances. And the colloquy between Judge Sturman and counsel for Loretta was, well, that doesn't matter unless he can prove that it interferes with her livelihood. That's on page 43 of the hearing transcript. And I think what our argument is he should get that chance to at least try and prove it. And with that, I'm out of time, but if Your Honor's
well,
have any questions.
Let me see if my colleagues have any questions for you. They may. Just a silver.
You said on the page of the transcript, what is the record on appeal on that?
You know what, I am not certain. I'm not sure that it was included with the
appendix.
That's correct.
May I?
Of course.
Because I know we talked a lot on that side, but why I appreciate you know what you're saying, but it seems to be we should have the argument is in this matter we should have an evidentiary hearing to allow Mr. Powell to basically supplement or fill in things he left out. Why does Loretta Powell have to go to a hearing to see maybe if he fills in the blanks? I mean, I think I just want to flip the imposition here, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense, and that is a very valid and good question. And what our argument is this isn't a case where there's absolutely nothing, and it's just somebody coming in with a whim saying, I don't think my mother can handle things. Here, Mr. Powell did have a study done by a physician over numerous months, and he presented what he thought was sufficient. The argument that Mr. Bogatz and I are making today is there is a concern that if the clear and convincing evidence bar is set at the initial threshold, that then maybe people who do have severe problems, who, you know, on a day that they were tested by an estate planning, you know, lawyer, maybe that day they were competent, but more often than not, they're not. Mm-hmm. It's that we do not believe that it is in anybody's or in society's best interest to prevent there from being an evidentiary hearing when there is at least some level of evidence.
But in this case, because we'll bring, I'm sorry, is that okay, Chief?
Oh, absolutely.
In this case, you know, if it was just William's petition standing alone that alleged there's a problem, a judge probably would have looked at that and said, yeah, maybe I should explore this because we do have a physician. It might not check all the boxes, but they didn't just have that physician's information. And the judge had a pretty comprehensive set of pleadings from which the judge could maybe conclude properly that they didn't need an evidentiary hearing going forward. So I
certainly understand that. And, yeah. Your Honor, what I would suggest that this court at least consider is that there was, you know, some colloquy on the record about, well, if Loretta is not competent 99 out of 100 days, but on the 100th day, she, you know, signs this certificate and that on that 100th day, then there's no need for a guardianship. And I think what that ignores is that there are different levels of guardianship that the legislature has made available. There's a guardianship of an estate. There's a limited special guardianship if somebody has capacity at times, but not all the time. There's nothing, you know, that Mr. Powell could have known because he's not an attorney. He doesn't know how to make those arguments and say, well, look, I'm not looking for a complete and total guardianship. It's okay if maybe it's just a partial limited guardianship over the estate. That way, Loretta gets to retain a lot of her personhood, but is still protected. And that is the argument that we're making, which is that the court does have broad discretion, as well they should. But the court should be encouraged to take evidence and take facts and allow there to be that adversarial process, because some of the allegations that Mr. Powell made were, you know, my brother has an undue influence and has stolen my mother essentially from her house and is hiding her from me, so I can't even talk to her before this hearing. you know, there were some concerning allegations that I think should have been tested in an adversarial manner. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else?
No.
Okay.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Amanda Nettishall. I'm a new admittee as of October 2020. As a new admittee with the courts just opening, this is my first live in-court appearance. I am here from the law firm of Goldsmith & Guyman with attorney Derek Goldsmith on behalf of our client, Loretta Powell. I am going to provide the court with a two-minute introduction and reserve 13 minutes for Ms. Goldsmith to provide argument and answer the court's questions. We are here today under the standard of review for abuse of discretion to show that the district court did not err in its decision to deny William Powell, our client's adult son, the appellant, an evidentiary hearing. It is within the discretion of the district court to grant an evidentiary hearing. And if one was required, the legislature would have made this clear and set forth such a requirement in NRS Chapter 159. The appellant has asked for this court to require that an evidentiary hearing be provided to a petitioner who requests one. It's important to note that this is not a due process issue, nor did the appellant comply with the statutory requirements to proceed with a guardianship. Accordingly, the dismissal by the court was akin to dismissing a complaint without prejudice. The appellant also requests that this court address the clear and convincing standard the district court used to deny an evidentiary hearing. The plain language of NRS 159.055 Section 1 provides that a petitioner under Chapter 159 has the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence that an appointment of a guardian of a person is necessary. The standard is the threshold to show that an appointment of a guardian is even necessary and is not a barrier of entry to an evidentiary hearing. Here, the appellant failed to make a prima facie case for guardianship, and thus his petition was properly dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dara Goldsmith for Loretta Powell. This court has held, absent a showing of abuse, it would not disturb the district court's exercise of discretion concerning guardianship determinations, that it needs to be satisfied that the district court's decision was based on appropriate reasons. Here, the district court's decision was clearly based on appropriate reasons, as the appellant did not establish, first and foremost, a prima facie case that guardianship was necessary for his mother. He did not meet the standard required. He didn't dot the I's and cross the T's in the statute. And the only physician certificate that was before the court opined that the protected person not only didn't need a guardianship, but she possessed the requisite capacity to execute a power of attorney, which is a less restrictive alternative to guardianship. This was a really important point with the legislature in 2017 when it enacted the Guardianship Bill of Rights to provide these types of barriers to entry to guardianship for perceived abuses in the system. So what Judge Sturman did was basically akin to a NRCP 12B5 motion to dismiss and granted the dismissal. The dismissal did not prevent the appellant from remedying his deficient pleadings and filing a timely motion to reconsider. Instead, he chose to appeal the matter. In fact, he had initially filed for temporary guardianship, and that's why in the record there is his disability certificate, which is not a full certificate. It's an 8-page report. There's only page 3. And then in the record, there's an additional page that has some modifications to it. I think that's really important because at the level when he went to get temporary guardianship, he learned that he was not going to have success. So that's why he went back to the physician. So I take issue a bit with the comments that he only had that one opportunity. In fact, because he had petitioned for the temporary, was denied, went back to that doctor. I think that's a very important fact in the case. The legislature is very cognizant that multiple filings may occur in guardianship, and matters may be refiled both in good faith or in bad faith. So it specifically included a vexatious litigant adjudication in Chapter 159, Most of the statutes or the chapters do not include a specific vexatious litigant determination. And unlike the protected person who's entitled to due process and may constitutionally have a right to an evidentiary hearing, or in some states, actually a jury trial, to determine questions of fact, because her personal liberties and her constitutional rights could be eviscerated by the imposition of a guardianship, the appellant is not and was not entitled to one. Here, William mistakenly believes that he was entitled to an evidentiary hearing because he could present evidence of what he perceived to be, quote, abuse from her and neglect from his brother. That's not what guardianship is about.
Ms. Goldsmith,
yes.
If we were to agree with your position and we were to when we were going to frame an opinion around this, this particular case, how would we go about that as far as was it really teed up below as far as this woman's right to an evidentiary hearing versus it appears to me it's more about the appellant claiming they have.
Oh, and this case is not the case for there to be an evidentiary hearing. An evidentiary hearing should have occurred if hypothetically, if my client, Loretta, easier to refer to her by first name, if Loretta did not have the physician certificate, and if the court was inclined to say, gee, William, we are somewhat impressed by this document you have here, but we're not going to do anything today. We're going to go out and have, you know, she's going to have an opportunity to have a hearing. And I'm sure Ms. Anderson, at that point in time, they would have secured a physician to do the appropriate, just like they did. They would have gone out and had that taken care of. I think here, the reason that the dismissal was appropriate was that he failed to meet the prima facie case. And you can have emergent circumstances, and I think I do have some concerns with the statute in that in NRS 159, it only talks about emergent circumstances for a temporary. And realistically, those emergent circumstances, like reports to Metro or Senior Protective Services or the State Attorney General's Office, depending on what jurisdiction you're in, could give rise that you are entitled to have this investigated. I do take issue that the legislature only left those emergent circumstances in temporary guardianships. So it almost makes the petitioner have to go through the extra step of filing for a temporary to argue.
A value if we were to do an opinion on guardianship and whether or not a petitioner makes a prima facie case for a district court to utilize its discretion, I guess is what I'm saying.
That's what I believe.
Is that helpful?
I think it's very helpful. I think if you have a prima facie case, or even if that prima facie case involves emergent circumstances, that you may go down the road to have an evidentiary hearing. And it's very important to note that the district court judge has a number of arrows in her quiver. And those arrows include, because her arrows include the ability to appoint a guardian ad litem, as well as the ability to appoint investigator. Those are newer statutes that were incorporated into Chapter 159, I believe, in 2017. And why that's important is because the counsel for the protected person is there to do what the protected person wants, not necessarily acting in the protected person's best interest. So if Judge Sterman had determined, based upon the evidence in front of her, that she felt, gee, maybe we need an investigator, maybe we need a report, maybe we need an independent person who isn't the person arguing that everybody gets a hot fudge sundae for lunch. They're saying, no, some people are going to have sliced steak with a salad on the side, because it's important to do what's in someone's best interest. But here we have two physicians who looked at the matter. She has a physician certificate as well as she has a report with a mini mental status exam score of a 28, which is very important. And I don't know if any of you have ever had a mini mental status exam given to you, but on any given day, any one of us could score a 28. I'll submit to you if I say to you, are you enjoying the summer weather today? And Justice Silver, if you say, this summer it's so hot, you're going to lose a point because it's spring. 1 point off for Justice Silver. Now, if you weren't great at math and you can't do serial sevens, subtracting 7 from 100, another point off. You've got to be able to do that like this. Spelling world backwards, another factor. Most of us have to think about that one. And finally, you have to remember 3 items and come back to them. And it's important to note that that's another way to lose points. So if I asked you to remember brief, clock, and gavel, and we come back to that, let's see how many people without writing it down or any kind of mnemonic are going to be able to get that right. In reviewing the transcript from the hearing, it's clear that Judge Sturman examined her options with regard to Williams' petition. The supporting evidence he supplied, the disability certificate, that one page three of an eight-page document. And through the record, it's clear that that evidentiary hearing lasted 58 minutes. I'd love to get 58 minutes before a district court judge, let me tell you. She considered the pleadings and statements of William, Loretta's estate planning attorney, and Loretta's court-appointed counsel from Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada. On no less than three occasions, the court noted that the certification presented by the appellant was still not enough to constitute a physician certificate. The court found the certification given by the appellant and the certificate completed by Dr. Sweeney, as compared to that, was not enough to contradict one another. She notes that the only physician certificate before her is the one provided by Respondent's Counsel, and at the time she says she's competent to sign a contract. That's a really high level for any of us who do probate and trust work. Testamentary capacity is a lower level. Contractual is much higher. That's the ability to basically go into a car dealership and buy a car, not merely knowing who your beneficiaries are and the types of assets that you own. The court emphasized how important it's always to choose the least restrictive means. And here the least restrictive means is a reference to the Guardianship Bill of Rights, which provides that a protected person has the right to remain as independent as possible and be granted the greatest degree of freedom possible. Per the only physician certificate before the court, the respondent had the requisite capacity to sign powers of attorney, which provides a valid alternative to guardianship. The court noted for the court to dismiss the petition, the court would need to find a proposed protected person is not in need of guardianship. She didn't simply rely upon the defective pleading for dismissal, which I submit she probably could have. And if the petition is not dismissed, an evidentiary hearing would be needed. With regard to the issue that's raised by William, that the court applied an erroneous standard of clear and convincing evidence as proof to be supplied in order to get a request for the evidentiary hearing. I think that the appellant is arguing that the court applied the wrong standard in determining whether the evidentiary hearing would be great, and relying upon her statement on page 58 of the transcript where she states that the appellant didn't support his petition by clear and convincing evidence to get us where we would need to have an evidentiary hearing. While this clear and convincing language is not ideal in the transcript, what is clear is that the appellant's failure to supply a physician certificate and the competing physician certificate finding capacity to execute powers of attorney is what Judge Sturman relied upon in dismissing the petition. Had Judge Sturman been presented with evidence satisfying the statutory requirements, a competing physician certificate would have gotten them where they needed to be to have an evidentiary hearing. It would have given rise to a prima facie case, and there would have been a valid question of fact for the court to look at with competing physician certificates. When I'm reading the by clear and convincing evidence from William, I think she's simply referring to a valid physician certificate. And I know that, and I'm sure that the justices here who've all been district court judges, when you have pro se applicants in front of you for 58 minutes, you can get a little tired in trying to get them on track. The appellant couldn't overcome this hurdle as he didn't present the medical documentation sufficient to show that the disability equated to needing a guardianship. Accordingly, since the appellant failed to establish a prima facie case, he lacked the physician's certificate, and the respondent had one to the contrary, I feel that the court did nothing in error. I think that the court, everyone had their day in court, and Loretta simply won. And while the applicant has other avenues that were available to him, he could have, as I said, filed a motion to reconsider, gone back to get a correct physician certificate. And in fact, what Judge Sturman said is, it was telling to her that he went back to the same doctor, and she refused to sign a physician certificate. And that was a very important fact to her. A couple other things. One of the things you questioned is whether he could go to Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada for counsel. He would not be able to. He would need to go to Nevada Legal Services. They offer guardianship assistance as well as the Southern Nevada Senior Law Program. If he's over the age of 60, he would qualify for counsel there. Of course, there's other options in other jurisdictions as well. And I think for those reasons that the decision of the district court should be maintained.
Okay, colleagues, any questions? All right, thank you. And counsel, it's so nice to have everybody back in person. And so we really appreciated seeing you here today and appreciate the briefing. This matter will stand submitted until the next.